Mr. Smith?
Yes, Your Honor.
You can approach. You have 15 minutes. Would you care to reserve any time for rebuttal?
I'd like to reserve 5 minutes, please, Your Honor.
5 minutes for rebuttal?
Yes.
Okay. You may begin whenever you're ready, and the timer's right in front of you.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the Court, my name is Christopher Smith. I represent the appellant, Jennifer Scheer. This matter arises out of Albemarle County Circuit Court, equitable distribution matter. Sole issue was the allocation of $450-some thousand of student loan debt in about 18 loans, of which all of which except for one, all of which other than one were in the name of the husband. My client was only jointly named on the first loan that the parties acquired. In 2011, significant amendments were made to 2107.3, specifically regarding the debt issue. And as a result of those amendments, the trial court was then imposed with two, among other things, two specific tests when faced with allocation of debt. And these were mandatory requirements. And the first one, under 1073A, was that the trial court shall and was required to determine the balance owed as on any debt that was being allocated as of the date of the separation. So that information, as of date of separation, was mandatory and had to be put forth. And then, once that information was produced, the second requirement per these 2011 amendments was that the court was then to determine, did the amount of the debt change in any way? Did it increase or decrease from the date of the separation to the date of the evidentiary trial so that the court could determine, has it gone up? Has it gone down? Is it due to one person's payments, one person's, non-payments, penalties, fees, etc.? The burden to produce this information is on the moving party, and in this case, that was the husband. And although the parties weren't too far apart on the dates of separation. The husband alleged June 24, 2010. The wife alleged June 24, 2011. Ultimately, the trial court found July 1 of 2011. So it was on the burden of the husband to produce this information. The husband not only did not produce the information for his own pled date of separation, but even after the trial court had made its initial two-day trial, the court went into significant efforts and gave Mr. Scheer multiple opportunities to come up with the information. Now, this was not a case, although the trial court originally thought that perhaps this information had simply been obtained, had been exchanged in discovery, and had simply been overlooked by husband's counsel, and it was in the book and it wasn't put forth. That isn't the case. In fact, the information was never there. He never even had the information for his own pled date of separation. So the trial court went through multiple hearings and gave the husband multiple opportunities to come up with that information. These are his loans. He's on all of them. Ultimately, he never did. And at the final time, when on June 23, 2017, when the trial court entered the order, the trial court was very clear that the evidence should not be considered by the court, but if considered, shall be deemed insufficient. That's Appendix 1546. That the evidence was not sufficient for the court to make a finding as to what the balances were as of date of separation, 1547 and 1548 of the appendix.
Can I interrupt you? I hate to do it, but your time goes by so fast here. Do I understand correctly that you are not challenging the 25% marital assessment, essentially, that 25% of these debts assigned to wife? That's not an argument you're challenging on appeal.
Well, I think, right, we're not challenging the allocation.
You're saying that
because the fundamental position to even allocate the threshold requirements that the husband had to show those balances as of date of separation, and then what have they gone up or down between date of separation and date of evidentiary trial, that was his burden. When he doesn't even meet that burden, there is no allocation that should even occur because the threshold requirement of equitable distribution has not been met.
So the bottom line is that you're saying this is a transfer and not an apportion. right?
Well, we also, right, we've also alleged under 2107.3C, which talks about, which is also dealt with in these 2011 amendments, that basically said the court can only apportion or allocate or transfer debts that are jointly owed. The only one of these loans, and Smishy and I refer to it as the signature loan or the student signature loan, it ends in 1939. It's about 20... It's about $20,000.
Of $28,000.
Yes, Your Honor.
It was the only one that's
the only
jointly.
One that's jointly. Now, everything else is only in his name. And so, right, one of the things we allege is that as an error, that under 107.3C, the trial court can't give all these additional loans that constituted the 25% that she ultimately did, even though she found the evidence was insufficient, had credibility issues and so forth, shouldn't even give it to my client because they're not loans. It's like a Visa card. It's in one person's name. You can't then say, oh, the wife, you need to pay, take responsibility and be responsible for husband's Visa card. I mean, the court could do monetary awards and so forth.
And obviously, that $28,000 is a lot less than 25%.
Right.
So hence my question on, would it have been error for the court to have said to your client, I want you to pay 25% of these loans to husband, and then he's responsible for paying the bank back or the financial entity.
Right. I think if the husband fundamentally had carried his initial burden and had shown balances as of date of separation, had shown balances as of date of evidentiary trial, which would then give the court the ability to go through the equitable distribution process, right. And then if the court determined, now we don't think that any percentage should be given to wife, but if the court said, you know what, I think 25% to you, wife, is appropriate, then the court could have had the legal authority to put the signature loan on wife's responsibility and then said, you know, ultimately, if we think you should owe more, then here's what you should pay husband, and that between that and the signature loan would constitute the 25% that the court thought would be appropriate.
So let me follow up on Judge Beal's question so I make sure I know what you're saying here.
Sure.
The scenario here is a bit unusual because from the standpoint that there are no assets, you've got all debt. And we're talking about all debt.
Yep.
Debt can't be transferred when it's in the name of the one party.
Right.
That's your position.
Right.
So the judge was left with trying to figure out how to apportion it. And your position is that if the judge had simply, whatever that 25% is, if the judge had simply said, instead of the way it reads now, if the judge had simply said, you owe husband that amount, mm-hmm. and to be paid over a period of X months in whatever percentage, that would be okay.
Assuming the fundamental threshold question, which the trial court, by its own admissions, the evidence was insufficient, there were credibility issues, the court said it should not be considered, this is on the day it entered the order, shall not be considered, the court has deems insufficient, the court is not making findings as to balances owed as of date of separation, the court is not making findings as of maximum balances owed on the loans. I mean, the court basically, point blank, came out and said, you did not give me the information after multiple efforts laid out in the briefs to get us this fundamental information that you needed to provide as the moving party, because you're the one who's asking for relief under 2107.3, but nevertheless, I'm going to go ahead and make this allocation. So to answer your question, Judge Decker, yes, if they had done it properly, and let's assume we had the statement that showed as of July 1, 2011, here were the balances, we had the statement that showed exactly what it was in this trial, then the second question is, yeah, if the court said, I think 25% is appropriate to you, wife, then the court could stick her with a signature loan, because that's the only one that's joint, and if there was another, you know, $50,000 that the court felt was appropriate to come up with 25%, it could say, and I'm ordering you to pay husband the sum of $50,000 in this manner over this period, as the court could normally do in an equitable distribution case, because he's the only one who has the ability to refinance, control them. She has no access of any of them other than the one little loan that the first one they put in place. Now, by no means am I asserting that 25% is appropriate. I guess my position to your question, Your Honor, was because we believed that the court fundamentally didn't even reach its fundamental requirement on the application of the statute, we don't even get to the allocation process.
So talk about that before your time runs out.
Certainly. So, I mean, that's basically there was the objections to the information not being produced. I mean, once again, this divorce was filed in May of 14. The statute was effective July 1 of 2011. The husband had pled his date of separation, so it's not a case where he even came in with statements saying, here the loan balances as of June 2410. You've now thrown me off, Judge, because you used July 1, 2011. I don't have that information. He never even had the information for the date that he even pled himself. Moreover, he was given multiple opportunities by the trial court, as we lay out in the brief, multiple hearings over, from 2016 in February when we did the two-day trial on the merit, and I wasn't counsel below, to June of 2017 when we do the final order of divorce. There's several hearings which we lay out in the brief where he's given the opportunity. He still doesn't come up with the information. And at the end of the day, after three or four different hearings, what he has, the trial court says, on point. It's insufficient. There are problems with credibility. It's not, should not be considered. But was basically saying, well, the evidence is the evidence, and you know, even at the May 27, 2016 hearing, counsel for the husband said, what we didn't give you, speaking to the judge, was the balances as of the date of separation. Now, whose burden this is a mixed bag. I don't know. That's Appendix 1280. And so Ms. Mishy, as the moving party, maybe she didn't realize that that was her responsibility. Well, the statute had been in place since 2011, but that's her information. Her client's the one who's got the statements, who's got the online information. And so we go round and round about what the court did and shouldn't do, and should the court have given her all these opportunities post-trial to get the information. Even if you say, well, that's within the discretion of the trial court to do that, by the time we come up in June 23, the court said, having given you all these opportunities, what you've produced is still not sufficient, and it's not credible, and I've got a problem with it, and it doesn't meet the requirements of the statute. So, that's where we're at. I want to retain my time.
That's fine. Thank you, counsel. Any other questions? Okay. Thank you, counsel. Ms. Fisher?
As a preliminary matter, Your Honor, if you have the list of the loans in front of you, on July 1, which the court found to be the date of separation, what two loans paid out, and those were numbers 17 and 18, in the list of the loans, we know the balances on that date because that's the date the loan started. And the court, although asked at that last hearing to at least find that she knew the balances as of that date, declined to do so. And those balances were part of the joint stipulation that were turned in by both counsel.
The balance on those last two?
Those last two loans. Those two bad boys were incurred prior to the date of separation in the sense they'd been applied for, they'd been approved, but they actually paid out on July 1st, 2011. That was the date the court finally determined to be the date of separation. And although counsel talks about the fact that the date of separation was a known entity to all the parties, if you read Mr. Lewis's opening statement and then you listen to what he was alluding to during his closing, he was even suggesting that he was going to try and backdate the date of separation to when the parties were still living together, but I guess they were going to be separate and apart under the same roof. It was a floating number.
Well, you have the trial court making a finding of fact,
yes,
that July 1st is the date of separation. But can I ask you then,
yes,
the two loans you just mentioned, the date of the loan is July 1st. Why wouldn't those loans at that point be, why could any of that be attributed to wife, particularly any interest that accumulates after the date of separation, since the loans aren't even issued until the date of separation?
As I pointed out in my brief, Your Honor, this is a very strangely worded statute. Loans incurred prior to the date of separation are presumed to be marital. Loans incurred after the date of separation are presumed to be separate. What happens to loans that are issued on the date of separation, we know not. They are neither presumed marital or separate. But these were used for marital purposes, and the testimony was very clear that the money that went out supported the entire family. It supported Ms. Shear and the children in Charlottesville because she was not working. It supported my client in a house he had rented because he thought they were coming with them. And it supported them when they were all together when she was bringing the children in for visitation. So those loans were marital. And we know what the interest did to those loans because we have the date of separation balance and we have the final balance. Now, the second issue I'm going to raise with the court is the subsidized loans, because we took judicial note, or we asked the court to take judicial notice of the federal statutes that said, so long as the party is actively engaged in the program, the government pays the interest. So those loans would have had exactly the same balances that they would have had on the date they were issued, and those balances were stipulated to. Now, could the court take judicial notice? Absolutely. And we have several cases on that, but the most, I think, telling is Settlement Funding LLC versus Newman Lilio, which was at 274 Virginia 76. It's a 2007 case where post-trial, 2 weeks post-trial, party trying to prove the interest rate in the state of Utah brought the law back to the trial court. Trial court said, you didn't give it to us during the trial, ergo, I can't recognize it. Supreme Court reversed and said, no, you absolutely have to take judicial notice of that. Now, the argument that the trial judge came up with as to why she couldn't take judicial notice was Williams versus Commonwealth. I will confess to you right now, I have tried one criminal case in my life. It scared me to death. I will never do it again, so do not expect me to put this to be my area of expertise. But this part I got. Apparently, they forgot to prove the venue where the crime happened. And the trial court was asked by the Commonwealth to take judicial notice of where the location was. Trial court never said what it did. Didn't say it during the trial, didn't say it in post-trial motions. Just denied the motions of the defendant and went on. Now, this court got hold of it and looked at it and said, well, they must have taken judicial notice of the fact that this is located in the proper venue and therefore the crime is a good one. Supreme Court went, no, you are not allowed to assume what the trial court was thinking. The trial court's supposed to tell you. And they never told the defendant. The issue wasn't whether it was post-trial or during the trial. The issue was, you never said. And it doesn't in any way affect the ruling that came out in Settlement Funding. Court should have taken judicial notice of the statutes. They specifically lay out that if you are in the program, the government is paying the interest. So all of the subsidized loans, which are numbered 2, 5, 8, 11, and 15, we know the balance of as of the date of separation. That's not an issue. And if we had not gotten to the invited error question, which I'm about to get to, had the court had before it the argument that, in fact, we needed to know the balance as of the date of separation, the court then, my client, could have testified that these were subsidized, and the interest was being paid right actually past the date of separation, because he didn't get kicked out of the program until March of the following year.
But the actual loan materials in the record?
Yes.
So they're there?
Yeah. What was in the record was the statements of the loans that showed their original balances, the balance as of the date or close to the date of the trial, because you can't get quite on the money. And you also had the balances, the interest rates,
but
and whether they were subsidized or unsubsidized.
Yeah.
Yes, that was right there on the exhibits that the trial court did finally admit. And under the pretrial order, they would have come in. Now, let me get to what I find to be the most concerning argument from my side, which was the invited error argument. There was a soliloquy on the part of the plaintiff's counsel with the judge when she asked how long was it going to take. Never ask a lawyer an open question, and I guess that was one. And he went on to explain to her what she was going to have to do. And he told her, you're going to have to decide if these loans are marital or separate. And if you find that they are, in fact, marital, you are going to then jump down to 2107-3E, and you're going to go through the factors and decide whether to allocate them. And, you know, under the statute, he's not wrong about that. This statute isn't the best wording the legislature has ever come out with. And although it tells the court it must make a finding about the balances as of the date of separation, which isn't even possible if it's a post-separation loan that the court finds to be marital, it doesn't tell you what to do with it. And it's not part of the considerations that are listed in 20-107-3E. So, we take the jump. We don't put that evidence on because counsel has told the court what the issues are. I'm relying on that. The court is relying on that. We go through. We finish. No motion to strike. Nothing to suggest that there has been the alleged error. We get to the ruling. He asks the court, did you make a finding as to the date of separation balances? She says yes, and he doesn't say another word. And then he submits an order that doesn't even object to the fact that there is no finding as to date of separation and date of trial balances. He submits an objection that says it was supposed to be date of separation in lieu of date of trial. Now, admittedly, if I had simply shut up and let that order go through, we probably wouldn't be talking today because he would not have preserved his objection sufficiently for the record because he made the wrong one. But I went back and I asked the court to take judicial notice of the interest rates. And they were exactly the same interest rates that appeared on the documents we had not entered because we had this wonderful stipulation about what the balances were as of the date of trial, and then said, run the interest rates on the unsubsidized loans, and we'll be able to tell you pretty closely what the balances were, close enough for the purposes of the trial court. Now, the primary argument that appellant is making to this court is because there is mandatory language, there is reversible error. The first problem we run into is it was invited error. And if the court goes back and looks at, and if you can give me 2 seconds because I can't read my own writing, invited error under Harvey versus Commonwealth, there is in our brief the statement the Supreme Court made that talks about criminal trials where, heaven's sakes, there you would be the most protective. And civil trials, which is don't tell the court what to do and then tell it it committed reversible error when it did it. And the situation we had here is she followed appellant's instructions to the letter. She found the loans to be marital. And it's important to note that in her ruling, she said early out that I consider that July 1 loan to be marital because although it didn't pay out until July 1st, it was in fact applied for and approved prior to that date, and those were the dates she was looking at to determine it had the marital presumption. But even if it didn't have the marital presumption, it didn't have the separate presumption because it wasn't post-date of separation, and it was used for marital purposes. Her finding that it was marital was supported by all of the evidence. The situation that we get back to, then, is that what could the court do on the other loans if, in fact, it needed the information? And I'm going to come back very quickly, I hope, to the fact it didn't need the information.
When you say the other loans, what do you
mean? The unsubsidized loans or the direct loans. And those loans, she had the interest rates. She accepted the calculations as to what their balances would be if they had simply been run without any payment on them. But then she said that information is insufficient. Now, I'm running out of time, so I'm going to ask the court to go back because I thought I laid it out really clearly when I ran almost 5 words short of what would have put me over your limit. on what happened vis-a-vis those loans in terms of, you know, we gave her the interest rates, but when counsel says
can
that
I,
we
can
never...
Can I ask you on that?
I'm sorry.
Since you're running out of time, and can you explain to the court a bit more why what Judge Higgins did here was not a transfer, but it rather was an apportionment?
It ordered her to pay a specific set of loans, and that's an important point because counsel and myself, when we were writing the order, decided it was easiest for the wife to take the loans she took. And that's not in the transcript, but it is not any part of a specific appeal. And the language says that she will pay them and hold him harmless. She's not ordered to own the loans. And frankly, you couldn't do that because it's unconstitutional. You're interfering with the lender's rights under those loans, and you can't do that.
She essentially, by paying the loans, isn't that essentially the same as transferring?
Effectively, Your Honor, I don't see that there is a difference between paying and transferring.
Then isn't that a problem since the General Assembly has said you can't transfer
a loan? No, and let me tell you why it isn't. Because she is never going to have it showing up on her credit report. It is not, per se, her debt except as through the ordered payment. And it has the same net effect if you simply said, pay 25% of all the loans. Counsel all worked out what 25% would be, picked out specific loans for her, and the advantage to her is she can now pay them off. Because if she just pays the entire balance on those loans, and perhaps by borrowing somewhere else, she's got them gone. Whereas if you said 25% of each loan, what you've done is she'll never get them paid off unless he pays off the other 75%, and she can never come out from under. And given the interest rates that these helpful student loans charge, which should, under today's interest rates, be considered usury, we have a serious problem for her. This was the easiest way out, and it was agreed to by counsel. It wasn't until much later in the game, in the final objections, this was never made to the court before this order was signed.
So you're essentially arguing this was invited error, if it's error.
Absolutely. And I frankly think it was to her benefit. It was a decision made between the counsel to make this as easy for her as possible. And then we're suddenly hearing about it at trial. If you were to remand and send it back to the 25% across the board on the loans, we have a huge problem. Now, let me quickly get to you because I have 2 seconds left. Your Honors, if you will look at the cases that we've cited, there are many mandatory language issues like you must find the value of the separate property in making equitable distribution. The courts have disregarded that some years ago and said it's irrelevant. You must find the value.
Counsel, your time's up.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you.
We'll come down and greet. Oh, I'm sorry. Sorry about that.
I'll take advantage of every limit I can get.
That's right. We'll get. No, I'm sorry. You've got three.
Okay. Thank
three
you,
minutes
Honor.
And 4 seconds.
So let me be brief. Just because something is marital doesn't end the analysis, as Your Honors well know. Obviously, classification is one part of the equation. Valuation is the other part of the equation. In the supplemental appendix, starting at page 32, is the demonstrative exhibit that Ms. Michi references. In the very note by Judge Higgins on first page, supplemental 32, it says, note, Mr. Lewis, counsel for Ms. Shear at the time, disputes that it's marital regarding these debts. So very clearly, first day of trial, counsel for wife came in and said, this is a list. We don't even agree that these are all marital. That's in there at sub 32. The documentation and the dates that are listed here, none of that indicate separation date that husband alleged. None of them that indicate separation date that the court ultimately found, nor the one that wife had pled. As to 17 and 18, which are these...
So you're disputing stipulation.
Well, Ms. Misha comes in before the court and says, oh, it was all agreed to, this was all marital, and these were the numbers. The very note of the trial judge on the first day of the trial notes, Mr. Lewis, wife's counsel disputes, these are marital. He never came in and said, these are all marital. He never said, these are the amounts that are on the table to chop up. throughout the trial, at no point does he say the wife should assume X percentage of debt, and, you know, we were saying 10 or 15 or 40, and the court came at 25. The whole point was these loans were his loans, all but one. He didn't meet the information. They should all be assigned to him. We never agreed that they were all marital. We never agreed as to any portion that should be taken by him, and that's clearly in the record.
Mr. Smith, what about the invited error argument that counsel has made?
Right. So exactly on that point, that's where I was getting to. The only issue in this case, so a single-shot ED issue, although there was $450,000 of debt, it was all student loans. He had the burden of producing this information. This statute was put in place July 1 of 11, where the divorce was filed in 14. We're at trial in February of 16. The clarity of who had the burden was the husband. Wife didn't want any of these loans. He knew what he had to put forward. It had been in place for a couple of years. He failed to do so. There's nothing in the record that says, judge, we'll stipulate to the amounts, and we don't need to comply with the statute, and toss out what the legislature said. We'll just go with these numbers. 17 and 18, which are the ones that were on the own supplemental page 34, they say incurred July 1, 11. The statute says very clearly marital debt is debt that is incurred prior to date of separation. Trial judge said it was July 1. Of 11. So how can this debt be marital when it was incurred on the very date of the separation?
So what, under what assignment of error do you make that point?
About loan 17
and 18? Because it's after the date of separation or on the date of separation. Is it your last one? Or what? I'm just trying to see where you assigned error to that.
Right. So I think, I'll just, in the interest of time, I'll let my brief speak for what it is. I guess our point of the matter is, even if that's the case, because they still didn't show, the document that Ms. Mishi references, payoff 1-6-2016. Well, the evidentiary trial was February of 2016. So even if the court says, all right, it was incurred before and we have these numbers on July 1, we don't have the numbers on the evidentiary hearing. So from that point, once again, we have noncompliance with the statute. At the end of the day, Judge Higgins said, I agree to judicial notice. And that's indicated in the 1546 to 1550 pages. And she says, even with judicial notice, the materials that you submitted, and Ms. Mishi says, they are in the file. On the motion to reconsider.
Your time is expired.
Okay. Thank you, Your Honor.
Got to be fair to both sides.
Certainly.
We'll now come down and agree.